Chapter 55. Occult Detection. On a June day in 1943, a young house painter named Pieter van der Hoek slipped and fell 30 feet from a ladder. When he woke up in the Zodwal Hospital in The Hague, he had a severe skull fracture and a broken shoulder. As he opened his eyes, a nurse was holding his wrist, taking his pulse. Suddenly, a clear picture came into his head. He said, painfully, "Be careful. I can see you on a train. You may lose a suitcase that belongs to a friend of yours." The girl looked at him in amazement. "As a matter of fact, I have just arrived by train, and I did leave a friend's suitcase behind in the dining car. How did you know?" But Pieter van der Hoek had no idea how he knew. The idea had simply come into his head. When the nurse had gone, he turned to another patient and found himself saying, "You're a bad man." "Why?" asked the patient with some amusement. "Because when your father died recently, he left you a gold watch and you've already sold it." The man gasped. "My God, you're right. How did you know?" Many people were to ask Pieter van der Hoek, soon world famous as Pieter Hoekos the Clairvoyant, that same question in the future. And science is still unable to answer it. Hoekos can pick up some common article, a glove or an umbrella, and suddenly know about the owner. In 1958, Hoekos was asked by the police of Miami, Florida, to sit in the cab of a murdered taxi driver and to give his impressions of the killer. As he sat there, Hoekos described the murder of the driver in detail. And then he went on to describe the killer. Tall and thin, a tattoo on his right arm, a rolling walk like a sailor. His name, Hoekos said, was Smitty, and he had been responsible for another murder in Miami, a naval man shot to death in his apartment. The police were amazed, for there had been such a murder recently, but they had not connected it with the cab driver killing. Smitty sounded an unlikely name, but many Smiths are given that nickname. And the police came up with a rogues gallery picture of a sailor called Charles Smith, and it was identified by a waitress who described a conversation with a drunken sailor who had boasted of killing two men. A wanted notice for Smith went out to police stations all over America. Smith was recognised in New Orleans after a hold-up and sent back to Miami. He was charged only with the murder of the cabbie and sentenced to life imprisonment. This raises the absorbing question, how can anyone see things that are not actually present? Hoekos has been tested hundreds of times by parapsychologists, and so has another remarkable Dutch clairvoyant, Gerard Croisé. Both have been found to be genuine, and both have helped to solve many murder cases, and yet their powers remain incomprehensible to science. One of the most convincing theories has been suggested by the American student of parapsychology, Alan Vaughan, in his book Patterns of Prophecy. Vaughan begins by speaking of the concept of synchronicity, invented by the psychologist Carl Jung. Synchronicity is another name for coincidence that isn't really coincidence. We've all been amazed by some million-to-one chance, perhaps going to a strange city and bumping into an acquaintance from the other side of the world, or hearing a word or a name for the first time, and then hearing it several more times in the course of the same day. On these occasions, we have a suspicion that fate is taking a hand. Certainly there can be no possible doubt about the reality of precognition, knowing something before it happens. There's a machine at the Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn for testing precognition. It flashes a series of five lights in a random manner. Each flash comes a split second after an experimenter has pushed a button to try to predict which light will come on next. After 100 or so tries, most people score precisely what would be expected from chance. But for some odd reason, a few people can produce scores consistently that are 1,000 to 1 above chance. What Alan Vaughan suggests is that if synchronicity is a meaningful coincidence without a normal cause, then this is the same as saying that it has a paranormal cause, a cause that goes beyond what we regard as normal. This sounds rather mystical, but it's not necessarily so. There are millions of patterns that are not obviously visible to the naked eye, the patterns inside the atoms, the patterns of the planets in the solar system. Is it not possible that human beings also fall into types or patterns, and that therefore, in a sense, they're already carrying their fate around inside them when they're born? This is not to say that everything that happens to them is predestined. Perhaps it's only a general pattern, with plenty of room for variation. But this would certainly help to explain, for example, how the psychic Jean Dixon was able to state in an interview in Parade magazine in May 1956, "As for the 1960 election, it will be dominated by Labour and won by a Democrat, but he will be assassinated or die in office," effectively foretelling the Kennedy murder with frightening accuracy. Discussions of the precise nature of these powers of prophecy and precognition could go on forever, but one thing seems to be unarguable. We all have the potential of suddenly knowing things that we can't possibly know in the ordinary way. Sometimes it's simply a strong hunch. Sometimes a premonition may come in a dream. Sometimes we may actually seem to hear a voice inside the head. One interesting point emerges from the experience of Pieter Hircus. After he left the hospital, he continued to possess second sight, but he was completely incapable of returning to his old job as a house painter. He was no longer able to concentrate. He was like a radio set picking up too many stations at the same time, and he only solved this problem by deciding to use his powers on music hall stages. It's possible that we don't usually possess powers of precognition or second sight because we don't want them. They would make everyday life extremely difficult. And so it seems increasingly likely, as the study of parapsychology is taken up by more and more universities, that our ancestors were not simply revealing ignorant credulity when they believed strange tales about dreams. Dreams are one of the methods by which the subconscious mind speaks to us. All modern writers who've discussed the case of Moriah Martin and the murder in the Red Barn have asked whether it can be true that the victim's stepmother had a series of dreams in which she saw Moriah murdered by her lover, William Corder, and buried in the Red Barn. But most primitive people would take it for granted that a dream could reveal a murder. The writer Norman Lewis, who spent some time with the Mexican shaman, the medicine man Ramon Medina, described how in the village of San Andre, Medina sensed death and walked straight up to a house where the corpse of a murdered man was found concealed in the attic. Lewis adds that everyone in that part of the world, even the Jesuit missionaries, would accept that Medina had discovered the corpse by extrasensory perception. It's simply taken for granted. The case of Moriah Martin is by no means the only one that has been solved by extrasensory perception. There are dozens more, and many of them are better authenticated than the Red Barn murder. The remarkable Buer case, which took place in Canada, was solved by a thought reader. The Buer family ran a farm at Manville near Edmonton, Alberta. On July the 9th, 1928, a multiple murder took place at the ranch. The son, Vernon Buer, contacted the police and notified them that he had found his mother and his brother shot dead. And when the police arrived, they also found the bodies of two farmhands named Crombie and Rossick. Crombie was in the bunkhouse, Rossick in an outhouse, while Mrs. Buer had been killed in her kitchen and her son Fred in the next room. They had all been shot with a .303 rifle. The question of motive was baffling, for nothing had been stolen. The police soon discovered that the murder weapon belonged to a neighbour named Charles Stevenson. However, Stevenson alleged that it had been stolen from his home the Sunday before the murder. The local police chief had recently heard about a Viennese psychic called Dr. Maximilian Langsner. He had recently appeared in the newspapers when he had helped the Vancouver police to trace some stolen jewellery by reading the mind of a suspect. Langsner was asked if he would come and help. He attended the inquest on the victims, and when it was over, he told the police that the murderer was the man who found the bodies, Vernon Buer. He had also read in Buer's mind precisely where he had hidden the rifle. Langsner led the police to a clump of prairie grass on the Buer farm, and the rifle was found there. The question was motive. Langsner had to admit that he had not been able to find out why Vernon had killed four people. However, he said that if he could be placed somewhere near Vernon Buer for a short time, he should be able to remedy this. Buer had been booked as a material witness and was in the cells in Edmonton. He looked up suspiciously when Langsner sat on a chair outside his cell, but when the little man only sat there staring into space, he gradually relaxed. An hour later, without a word, Langsner stood up and went into the police chief. "I found out why he did it." Vernon had wanted to marry the daughter of a local farmer. His mother, something of a martinet, had refused her consent, and after a violent quarrel in the kitchen, Vernon had seized the rifle and shot her. He had then been forced to kill his brother in the next room. The hired men might have seen him enter the farmhouse, and so he crept up on them and shot them too. "Was there any evidence for this?" the chief asked. "Well," said Langsner, "a little woman in a poke bonnet had seen Vernon sneak out of church on Sunday, at the time the rifle was stolen. It wasn't difficult to find her. Her name was Erna Higgins. And when she confronted Vernon with the words, 'I saw you leave the church the day Charlie's rifle was stolen,' Buer suddenly broke down and confessed to the murders. His description of what had occurred corresponded in detail to what Langsner had said. He was hanged on April the 29th, 1929. As to Langsner, he remained on the American continent, moving to a small hut in Alaska, near Fairbanks, to continue his research into brainwaves, and it was there that he died a few years later. Whether the study of brainwaves would have given him insight into his own peculiar powers is debatable. Physiologists have identified various brain rhythms, alpha, gamma, theta waves, but none of these seems to have anything to do with thought transference. Possibly Langsner was reasoning falsely from his own powers to read minds. Both Peter Hurkos and Gerard Crosset have the same power, but they can also sense what has happened to objects. And objects obviously have no thought waves to transmit. What they may have is some kind of field. One writer on parapsychology, Edward Russell, suggests that these may actually be thought fields that have become attached to particular objects, especially if they've been involved in powerful negative emotions, violence, for example. Many years ago, C.J. Lambert produced a remarkable book called Together We Wandered, describing how in 1928 he and his wife had set off on a world cruise and bought a statuette of the Japanese god of luck, Hotei. From then on, their bad luck was constant and appalling, mostly in the form of incomprehensible toothaches. When they showed Hotei to another couple, the couple were convulsed with toothaches. And it suddenly struck Lambert that when Hotei was packed in his baggage, he had toothache. When the god was transferred to his wife, she had toothache. Back in London, he took the statuette to a Japanese art shop. And the manager, an art expert, explained that certain temple gods were given souls, small papers engraved with magic symbols and hidden inside them. This was one. Obviously, Hotei's soul was capable of causing toothache to anyone who treated him without due respect, for example, who lugged him around the world, packed among their shirts. The manager placed the god on a shrine, lit joss sticks in front of it, and Lambert walked out of the shop, leaving his toothache behind. This is obviously not an explanation of the odd powers of Hurkos and Crosset, only the beginning of a theory. There are many people who would take a totally different view, that such strange happenings may be due to the active intervention of the dead, for example, in the Red Barn murder. Similarly, in the case of the sex murder of 10-year-old Mona Tinsley, the medium Estelle Roberts was able to tell the police that the body had been dumped in a river. Many months before, it was found in the River Idle. A 44-year-old degenerate named Frederick Nodder was executed for that murder in 1937. In this case, the medium's prediction did not actually lead to the finding of the body. On the other hand, in October of 1956, the South African medium, Nelson Palmer, was able to lead the police to the naked body of Myrna Joy Aiken in a culvert near Durban. The girl had been seen entering a Ford Anglia car, and the police traced this to a radio shop, where the manager was able to tell them that on the day of the murder, it had been used by a salesman called Clarence Van Buren, who had since vanished. Buren was finally arrested near Pinetown and charged with the sex murder of the girl. He insisted on his innocence to the end, claiming that he had fled only because he knew he had been seen in the girl's company on the day of her death. Nevertheless, he was convicted. He had a considerable past record of crime, forgery, theft, bad checks, and was in possession of a revolver of the same type that had killed Joy Aiken. Not long after leading the police to Joy Aiken's body, Nelson Palmer duplicated his feat, leading the police to the body of a doctor who had committed suicide. No general theory covers all these phenomena, but now that parapsychology is at last being taken seriously by so many researchers, The day can't be far off when some parapsychological Einstein finally produces a key to the strange world of the occult.